Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. Our first guest this morning is Wall Street Journal writer Megan Cox Gurdon. She joins us to discuss her new book, The Enchanted Hour. It brings to light the neuroscience behind reading, and specifically reading aloud. Gurdon argues that this ancient practice is a fast-working antidote to the fractured attention spans that we all seem to have due to the distraction, the many distractions of the tech era. And it helps to replenish what our devices are leaching away. For everyone, reading aloud engages the mind in complex narratives, she says. And for children, it's an irreplaceable gift that builds vocabulary, fosters imagination, and kindles a lifelong appreciation of language, stories, and pictures. Megan, welcome to Cool Science Radio. Nice to have you.
Oh, I'm so happy to be with you, especially on Valentine's Day, right? This is a perfect topic connected with the idea of love.
Yes, love and love for reading. Isn't that what we hope that we foster in our children as they grow up? And, you know, we're a science and technology show, as you know, and we thought it would be really interesting to take a look, you know, maybe first of all at how distracted we are by our technology and our devices, to the extent that some of us have to read in little short snippets, it seems. You hear more and more about that, don't you?
You do. And, I've seen one estimate that the average adult attention span has dropped from a whopping 12 seconds at the turn of the millennium to 8 seconds today. And that, of course, that detail is like probably a couple of years out of date now. And I would shudder to think how short our attention spans really are. As adults, we do tend to hop around. And as we know, you know, our devices have this quality in which they sort of seem to fragment our mind. You know, you can be talking to someone and half of your mind is on something you saw online, and the other half of your mind, how many halves do you have, is, you know, aware of your phone in your pocket that just dinged, and you're not really present with the person you're talking to. So, in fact, what is that attention span? Impossible to calculate. But here's the thing. With children, it's so important that they be able to focus and concentrate. As adults, we can, you know, if we want to be on Twitter all the time, well, we can be on Twitter all the time, and it's up to us to make the best of it. But for them, they really need to focus and concentrate and be able to follow, you know, the line of someone's speech in order to understand what's being spoken to them, what ramifications it has for them. Because there's a direct line between the attention span persistence of children at the age of 4 and their ability to do well in math and reading at age 21. And in fact, it predicts whether or not they will graduate university by 25. So that has been measured, and it's extremely important that they be able to pay attention, and there are bad consequences if they can't.
And yet we are catering more and more to the fact that our attention spans are shorter and more fractured. I mean, if you think about the content that even young children are finding on their mobile devices, they are designed for the shorter and shorter attention span. And so how do we counter that?
Well, so this is where, of course, reading aloud really is an actual antidote. It's like a broad spectrum antibiotic against the effects of technology. If you think about them, what does technology do? It sends, if you take a particular household, it sends each member of the household off into their own separate virtual reality. Reading aloud is an immediate counteraction to that, because it brings us together in warm physical proximity, where, in fact, we get strong physiological rewards. You know, when a parent and child sit down together to read, immediately there's a chemical alteration in the two of them. The stress hormone cortisol declines, the bonding hormone oxytocin increases. So there's like a genuine, perhaps you've had this experience with reading, there's this sort of extraordinary feeling of well-being that can steal over you when you sit down with a book and a child. Well, it's not in your imagination, it's a real thing. And there's the question of attention as well. So if a child is just looking at, you know, pressing a screen, the child's brain is not deeply engaged. Some amazing research in Cincinnati at Cincinnati Children's Hospital has compared the effects of different kinds of stimuli on children's brains. when a child watches a video, essentially the brain is just registering the sort of visual onslaught of what's happening. But the deep brain networks, the ones that deal with introspective creativity, higher order memory and visual capacities, those brain networks aren't engaged at all. It's like nothing is happening except the visual. When you read a picture book to that same child, everything, I'm told neurologists, you're not supposed to say the word lights up. That's a layman's term. But since I'm a layman, I'll use it.
And so are we.
All these networks, all these networks in the brain engage, they synchronize, they connect. And that's very important because when children are young, especially, that's the time that their brains are, you know, forming their neural pathways for later thought and processing. So it's a really marvelous exact antidote to what technology is doing to the child's brain.
And your child is laying there and you're reading this book to them and their imaginations start to take off. And as you accentuate different words, as you help out with the imagery and helping them with their imagination about, can you imagine being in that place and dark in the woods or, you know, something like that? I mean, that just encourages that entire process, doesn't it?
You know, the writer Anna Dudney, who unfortunately died an untimely death a few years ago, you know, before she died, she asked that people, in lieu of, you know, sending flowers or whatever, that they would read to a child in her honor. And she had written about this exactly to your point. She said, you know, when we sit and read with a child, we are teaching that child to be human. And I think you're exactly right. The imagination, the imagery, the connection with language and story and history, that is all a deep and really rich experience. You know, there's nothing surface about it. It's everything gets engaged, not just the brain networks, but with imagination, that's like bringing to bear the full human person. And that's a really beautiful and important thing, too. We need civilized human beings.
And they're great memories for the adult and for the child, because my kids still talk about it. Now, this is a science show, and so let's talk about a little bit of math, because I found this fascinating. When you talk about learning being compounded through the years, you mentioned that 64%, and so we're talking, now we're getting into studies and stuff, 64% of U.S. fourth graders are not proficient in reading. And that probably means, because learning is compounded from the earlier age, that they may not have been proficient in the third grade, back to the second grade, or going back to preschool. And you also mentioned that 20% of our teenagers, one-fifth, are functionally illiterate, defined as they don't read or write well enough to navigate the working world. This is pretty scary.
It is scary, and there, again, are serious ramifications far beyond the question of whether people go to college or not. Yeah, I mean, poor literacy is linked with all kinds of unfortunate outcomes. I think perhaps you may have read this, but, you know, kids who get in trouble with the law, 85% of them are shown to have poor literacy skills. Mm-hmm. Prisoners in state and federal institutions, so adults who've run into trouble with the law, are in the same state. They also, poor literacy is a characteristic. And, you know, 43% of people living in poverty also have low literacy skills. I mean, you know, human life is complex. We cannot necessarily trace any one outcome to any one input. And as I do say in the book, you know, reading aloud to children is not a guarantee of a perfect life or a perfect family. But it is about as close to a magic bullet as we have, and it doesn't cost anything. And those early academic deficits that you described, you know, this is very important, too, because, in fact, in the earliest days of development, I mean, right from infancy, a child's brain is alert and looking around and listening for the sound of its family's voices. That, you know, in newborns register the sound of their parents' voices. They know their parents from other people in the world. And so those the early engagement is absolutely crucial, because, as you say, you know, life is cumulative. Development is cumulative. Each skill builds on the last skill. And the more skilled, particularly with language, the more skilled that children become at acquiring words, the easier it is for them to acquire more words. And so the child who starts life having had stories read in the early years is at a
just a profound advantage that only increases as the years go on over children who simply were not in that position. So, I mean, there's a moral component to this, too.
And, Megan, when you look at major problems in our country, they're all so expensive to solve. And you quote children's book author Rosemary Wells, and I love this quote, "We could narrow the achievement gap by not spending a dime."
It's amazing, isn't it? And she's right. I mean, the truth of the matter is, you can read aloud, even honestly, even if you don't have anything but a magazine or a supermarket circular. I mean, you'd have to be a little creative, but you know, books are expensive if you buy them fresh in the bookstore. I mean, that's a fact. But books are not expensive if you go to the library or take them out of a child's school. There are lots of wonderful charities, the Dolly Parton charity, all kinds of charities that are working double time to try and get books into the hands of the people who need them. So I think there is, you know, there's a great desire on the part of a lot of philanthropists and educators to get this message out. The truth of it, though, is as James Patterson said, actually sweetly in a blurb for my book, you know, we can't trust the schools or leave it up to the schools to read to our kids and stimulate their learning in this way. It really starts right away in the home.
Megan, I want to ask you about, well, when I was growing up, I moved around a lot. I went to four different elementary schools, and each time I entered a new one, the sole method they had of placing me in, you know, in a reading group, and actually all across the board, even I would end up in a certain math group based on how I read aloud. And I know that back then we didn't know a lot about dyslexia, and I'm wondering, you know, if that is our measure by which we place children. I mean, so much is determined, right, from, you know, which reading group you get into in second grade or third grade or whatever it is. How has that changed? How do we find where we want to place children now, knowing what we now know about dyslexia?
Oh, that, I'm afraid you're taking me out of my area of competence. I'm afraid I can't tell you about that. I'm not an educator. I will tell you, however, that dyslexia, people who have dyslexia can understand a story read aloud or told aloud with the same skill as a person who is a very adept reader. And this is one of the extraordinary capacities of reading aloud. It comes to us in what Dante called our native language, which is speech. So dyslexia, right, is a problem of the wiring and not getting the brain to be able to make sense of the words on the page. As the neurobiologist Marianne Wolfe says, we were never born to read, but we're all born to understand speech. Mm. So one of the beautiful things that educators can do with reading aloud and starting as early as possible, and this is also true in the home, by the way, is you can read to a mixed group of people. So kids who are extremely good at school, A+, gold star kids, and you can read to the to children in that same group who really struggle, who may have dyslexia or undiagnosed learning difficulties, and they can get the story at the same time, pretty much with the same level of sophistication. And that is a wonderful thing. It's not a leveler, you know, in the sense that everybody gets compressed downward. It's a leveler in which everyone is lifted up, because we understand so much more, you know. Children and adults all can understand many more words that they hear in speech than they do on the page. You know, there might be strange words that you would, abstruse terms that you would never hear anyone speak around you, but in the context of a story, they make perfect sense. You know, the syntax and the context tells you what something would mean. Mm. And so this is accessible. It makes literature, it makes nonfiction, it makes all kinds of things accessible to people when they don't have to struggle with the words on the page. So I can't tell you how, you know, how to place a dyslexic child in a class, but I can tell you that but people with such difficulties have found great liberation in the experience of having things read to them.
Absolutely. I had a friend who read to his children, his high school children, And I believe I remember him telling me it was War and Peace, which I kind of cracked up about.
Wow.
But he was such a fervent supporter of reading aloud, you know, all the way through school and then on into adulthood. And again, you know, saying that some of the things that you've been talking about are, you know, that closeness, the richness of experience, the bonding are so important, but the language as well. And it makes me wonder about how much we, for example, I love podcasts, so I'm doing a lot of listening and I'm not really engaging. When we go on road trips, is it a podcast or do I read aloud to my husband while he's driving?
Well, it depends, I suppose, on your level of queasiness if you look at the page while you're driving.
Exactly.
No, I know this question comes up a lot. I mean, I love podcasts. I love even more audiobooks. I think that some of the most, you know, it's great to be on the receiving end of a very talented read aloud. I find I can manage, you know, some of the Henry James novels without too much difficulty. But like a book like The Golden Bowl is just, whoa, it's just more than I really have time to do. Whereas if I'm listening and someone else is doing the work of decoding the words and particularly the very ornate sentence structure, you know, it's very accessible in that way I was describing to you. The thing that we lose I hate even to say that there's a deficit to it, but mm-hmm. The thing that we lose when we listen to a podcast or an audiobook instead of having that live fugitive experience with another person is we miss out on the connection, right? We miss out on the emotional connection, the physiological reward, the interchanges that come up over, particularly with children and teenagers, you know, over the meanings of things or why a character is responding in a way that might seem, particularly with a book from the past or from the considerable past, might seem very strange to the modern, you know, the modern sensibility. So audiobooks are wonderful. I think that reading aloud, and I was surprised to find that a lot of people who are in the audiobook world kind of have this view as well, that there is still something better about the live read aloud experience because it is, you know, it's more like a live music experience or a live art performance, a ballet or something. When something is just happening in the moment, there's this quality to it that is that's really quite special.
It's very soulful, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, here's something else I'd really love to talk about, and that is that reading in company, reading out loud, is a fantastic thing to do, not just with children, but with our elders. And you mentioned soulful. It's been this, I was able in England, actually, to sit in on a reading group of Holocaust survivors. So these people are very advanced in years. They had very traumatic, you know, lives. And they told me just how incredibly deeply enriching it was to meet, well, you know, once a week in great literature. Essentially, that was their meeting point. And it was a way of lifting them up and out of the, you know, quotidian tediousness of having aching bones and living in, as some of them did, in nursing homes where, you know, there's not a lot of stimulating human engagement from day to day. You know, a lot of transactional, hierarchical engagement, but not a lot of, you know, person-to-person real discussion. And, you know, and that's loneliness, as we know, is increasingly a feature of life for everyone in the tech age, but it's particularly pronounced for many elderly people. So reading to elderly people, with elderly people, among elderly people, has been found to be enormously, you know, it's consoling. And also, you know, people can find themselves liberated, again, from the constraints of their bodies, but also from liberated to remember things, you know, to connect with poetry and stories and times of the past that they may have forgotten about or that were locked away behind, you know, mental degeneration, basically.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Megan Cox Gurdon. She has written a fascinating book that's just been published mid-January. It's called The Enchanted Hour, The Miraculous Power of Reading Aloud in the Age of Distraction. Megan, here on the program, we read a lot of science and technology books. And I love historical biographies, but I don't have a lot of time for them because of the, preparing for Cool Science. But I went on a trip recently. Every time I go on a trip, I grab an audio book on an historical biography. And I got this book by Ron Chernow, who's a very descriptive author. He's a Pulitzer Prize author who wrote this book, Grant. It's like 40 hours of audiobook. And I was thinking about this book after I started looking at your book. And, you know, his descriptions of some of the Civil War battles, I mean, I don't think a movie could bring me there like my own imagination could, and of course Ron's writing, but audiobooks can really spur the imagination even more than any movie.
Oh, I absolutely, but that's like imagination is like a muscle, right? Like all the rest of our bodies, if we draw on it, it's more nimble. I've been meaning to read that book, and perhaps audiobook is the way to do it. I was very struck by, there's a battle scene, the storming of the Bastille, in Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities, which I listened to on audiobook. And on the page, when you read the passage, it's really only a page and a half. Read, when the words are kind of brought into the air, brought to life, turned into speech by the reader, you get every single bit of it. You know, the texture of what was happening, the terror of what was happening, the ferociousness of these armed women who stormed the place. I do think that we, maybe hopefully, we're on the brink of a really sort of culture-wide rediscovery of the power of the spoken word and of the reading voice. It is something that is so good for us, and we benefit and become more deeply human because of it.
Part of becoming deeply human is enriching our vocabulary. And a few minutes ago, when you were talking about the difference between reading aloud versus listening to a story, an audiobook or a podcast, I was thinking that with vocabulary, if we're listening, we often skip over those words that we may not be familiar with. But if we're reading aloud, we stop, we struggle over it, we notice it, we wonder what it might be. I would imagine that amassing a much better vocabulary really takes place when you read aloud.
Well, it does. And I'll tell you something extraordinary, that even with, let's say you read to a child, you say, okay, we're going to read two picture books a day, right? A very small time commitment, a couple of minutes maybe. Most picture books are no more than, say, 32, 40 pages at most. And certainly in the last 50 years or so, the number of words in picture books is actually declining. So today's picture books have many fewer words than they did, say, 60 years ago. So setting all that aside, let's say you thought you were going to read two books a day to a child. Can you imagine how many words of text the child would hear at the end of a year? I will tell you. I know the answer to this question. The answer is 438,000 words that the child might not have heard any other place.
Wow.
And there's a vast number of novel words or words that you wouldn't hear in other contexts. One of the things that picture books do, right, is that they are, each book, I mean, this is true of all books, but in the case of picture books, just speaking of them specifically, some take place on the moon, or they may take place on the African belt, or they may take place in a house. The characters might be animals or space aliens or any number of things. And so when little children occupy this world of the here and now and the day to day, here is your bottle, here is your toy, here are the blocks, here is your electronic toy. Please do not give your children electronic toys, but if you do, that would be a thing you would say to them. Whereas when you read a picture book to them, you open up all these other worlds and all the words associated with those worlds and all the language that might be used by the people in those worlds. So, yeah, starting even from very, very early on, a child's vocabulary is almost immeasurably enriched by exposure to books read out loud. And if you get into books like Ron Chernow's book or to Dickens or some of War and Peace, like your friend, that's an amazing story. that there's really, the sky is the limit. And we have this fantastic, gorgeous, giant, sprawling eccentric ancient language. It's all there. All these words, they belong to everyone. You know, you don't have to be a professor to use an advanced vocabulary. It's accessible to anyone. We just have to reach out and take it.
Mm. Megan, before we let you go, since you have been the Wall Street Journal's children's book reviewer since 2005, that's a long time. I wanted to ask you about what are the elements in children's books that stand out? I mean, I can think, my kids are 24 and 20 now, but I can go back to the books we read in my mind when they were 5 years old and the repetition and things like that. So I'm wondering what those elements are that you look for in a great children's book.
Oh, that's a great question. You know, it's very much an art and not a science. So I look for a little spark of something. Let's say if we're talking about picture books, just either a spark of just kind of incorrigible fun and freshness, something you haven't seen before, or fun language, you could know, clever, or slightly language that slightly stretches the child's exposure to language. I mean, I'm a great fan of an ornate vocabulary, so I like to sell that as much as I can. I love in books, in novels for children, a lot of adventure. For me, that was always the thing. I like also food description. I think the best children's books have lots of detail of what everybody eats. And sometimes I think authors forget that. They just say someone went in and had dinner. And when you're a child, you want to know, well, what did they have for dinner? You know, what exactly did they have? Was there melted butter on their mashed potatoes? I look for beauty. I look for courage. I look, I look for the virtues, but not in a specific way in which I'm hunting for virtue in books. It's more that I'm looking for something that is humane and that encourages a kind of a cultured approach to the world, I suppose.
And I just want to mention, it came out yesterday in a Belfast, Ireland paper. Nikki is a 147-pound fluffy dog who goes to a library in Belfast once a week, and 10-year-olds read to her. And the 10-year-olds say that it's easier, people say it's easier for the kids because the dogs don't mind when you make mistakes and there's no embarrassment. And they also say that Nikki, the dog, is very accepting and attentive and patient as she listens to the stories. And her favorite story appears to be Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. I just wanted to mention
that. Well, that makes perfect sense because Nikki's that generation. I mean, that's the most beloved series, I think, probably of for everybody under the age of 30 now. I'll tell you something I did find in research for my book about dogs. So Nikki, I'm sure Nikki's a fine and well-balanced animal. But, you know, reading aloud is also very soothing for dogs. They find it comforting to have someone be with them and hear the kind of the soothing sound of the human voice, but not in any kind of confrontational way. And it's so good for dogs that the ASPCA is reading to dogs, you know, when they take in traumatized animals at their headquarters in New York. They have volunteers who come in and read to the dogs. It's very soothing for them. It helps calm them physiologically, even as it calms, you know, human children and human babies and humans of every age.
Oh, I love that story. My 14-year-old Jack is going to hear a book, I think, this evening.
Oh, I think you'll find that your relationship is vastly improved with him.
The gentle giant Jack.
Yes, who's ailing, and so he's going to love being read to.
Oh,
so thanks for that suggestion. Megan Cox-Gurdon is our guest, and her book is The Enchanted Hour, The Miraculous Power of Reading Aloud in the Age of Distraction. Wonderful conversation. Thank you, Megan, for joining us.
I am absolutely delighted to have been with you. Thank you for having me.
All right. Take care.
Thanks, Megan.